Our reading from the Hebrew Scriptures today comes from a book called the Book of Esther. And I've heard that it shows up on Jeopardy, or has showed up on Jeopardy. And there's two questions that always get asked, or not questions, what's the proper thing?
Two answers.
Two answers. And the answers would be, what is the book of the Bible? No, I don't watch Jeopardy. You just say, this book of the Bible does not contain the name of God, or even the word God in it. And the other question on Jeopardy would be, this book is the basis of the Jewish holiday Purim. And the question would be,
what is the book of Esther?
500 points, or whatever it is. I don't know how that goes. I need to start watching Mr. Trebek more often, I guess. It's an entirely secular book. God is never mentioned in it. And yet, Jewish faith and the confidence of God's presence is in the background through it all. We're going to read one short chapter from what is a very short book. I invite you to go home and read it. But just to let you know what has happened so far. We're in the Babylonian exile. Jerusalem has been destroyed by the Babylonians. People have been led off. And this may be about second generation of folk who are living there 20 or 30 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. And there's a king of Babylon who's pretty shallow and pretty short-tempered, who gets drunk with his buddies and invites his wife, the queen, to do a dance for all of his drunk buddies. And in an ancient Me Too moment, she says, no, bozo. In the Akkadian, it's much more dramatic. So she is summarily fired as queen, and the king decides he needs a new queen. And this sounds, how could this possibly happen nowadays? But he chooses his queen by sponsoring a beauty contest. That would never happen nowadays. And the winner of the beauty contest is this Jewish peasant girl named Esther, who, because Babylon just destroyed Jerusalem, does not have the kindest attitude toward Jewish folk. And in fact, there's a court, what we would call a minister of sorts, a prime minister of sorts, a government official, who is plotting right now to commit genocide against the Jews in Babylon and all throughout the empire. Esther's uncle gets wind of the plot and begins to mourn publicly. And here's what happens.
When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went through the city wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what was happening and why. Hatak went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city, in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued at Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Hatak went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hatak and gave him a message for Mordecai, saying, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. all alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come into the king for 30 days. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this." Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything that Esther had ordered him.
Thank you, Joshua. Have you ever heard the term imposter syndrome? It's a condition where you feel like you really aren't supposed to be where you are, that you don't deserve the position you have, or the job, or the assignment you've been given. When you have the imposter syndrome, there's a voice in your head saying, "This was all a mistake. I'm a fraud. If anyone knew who I really was or what I'm really like, they would all hate me. Someone's going to find out I don't belong here." Now, we all get it at some time or another. I get it every Sunday morning when I wake up. Now, usually it has no basis in fact, and you can laugh it off later, but not always. My wife Barb and I had almost fatal cases of imposter syndrome this week, and it was absolutely based in reality. We found ourselves somewhere we had no business being. It wasn't my fault, I swear. It began completely innocently. On Tuesday, there was a blurb on Vermont Public Radio that the Sanders Institute was hosting a 3-day gathering of amazing intellectuals and community and environmental activists in Burlington at the end of the week, and I thought it would be great to go and listen. But I couldn't find any information online about tickets, so I emailed my old Adirondack buddy, Bill McKibben, who happened to be one of the speakers, and I simply asked him by email, and I quote, "Can mortals get tickets?" And a couple of hours later that day, I got sent a link to order 2 tickets. And I go to the link, and I order 2 tickets. Fine, cool, no problem. Barb and I figured we would get to go to the first night of the event, sit in a big auditorium in an audience with several hundred eco-nerds from around the country, and listen to some smart people up on the stage. It would be great. Until we got to the Echo Center, and the evening wasn't like that at all. We walk in the door, and there's just a small line of people, each of them getting pre-printed plastic name tags, and we show an official person our paper tickets, and she goes through all the name tags, and she can't find our name. She goes, "Well, you can go in. We'll find out what the problem is." So we walk in to where everyone's going, and there is no big auditorium. It's a pretty small room with a pretty small stage at one end. And there are only about 150 people inside there. 150 people walking around with glasses of wine or local beer and a cheese plate. And I'm realizing that I recognize about half of them from TV or movies or the internet. There was Bernie and Jane Sanders, of course. It was the Sanders Institute. And over there I see a group of scholars, the very noticeable Dr. Cornel West of Yale, Harvard, and Princeton. There's Dr. Robert Moses of the Algebra Project, bringing math literacy to the inner city. And there's Naomi Klein, the author of The Shock Doctrine. And then I'm realizing I'm seeing politicians from all over. I recognize Representative Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii and Gus Newport, who is the former mayor of Berkeley and a great civil rights activist and good friends of both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And there, standing very tall in the back, is New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. And I'm starting to get really nervous now. I see news people. There's Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! and Cenk Uygur from Young Turks. And then Cynthia Nixon from Sex and the City is over by the cheese bar. And I noticed John Cusack in the corner trying to look incognito. And there's Susan Sarandon looking regal as always. And there's Danny Glover being, wow, just Danny Glover. And Barb and I realize with mounting horror that there is no audience of several hundred people here tonight. Everybody who is here because they are somebody. Somebody amazing who actually did something amazing to make the world a better place. And they all seem to know each other. And I don't mean know each other in the fake Hollywood air kiss way. They were shaking hands firmly and giving big bear hugs and saying hello to people that they haven't seen in years and have been involved in the civil rights struggle and doing all these amazing things. And then there was Barb and me wearing bright blue lanyards with no tag, with no name tag on it. We were nobodies in a room full of somebodies. Do you know that recurring dream you still have about showing up naked for your final exam? It was real life, except we were wearing clothes. I realize there has been a terrible error. We were not supposed to be there. We were not supposed to have had been given tickets. And you know that voice in your head that says, this is a mistake. I'm a fraud. Someone's going to find out I don't belong here. Well, this time those voices were entirely correct. We did not belong there. There was only one person who connects to the tribe I'm looking at who knew us and who could vouch for us, and he wasn't there that night. Thank you, Bill. So we're just kind of standing there looking really, really nervous and not sure what to do. I'm kind of holding a wine glass in front of my non-existent name tag. And then, warning, warning, I see that someone is striding purposely toward us. It is Jane Sanders, with a smiling but quizzical look on her face, as she asks us who we are. And I start glancing around for an emergency exit. Okay, this is how Esther is feeling right now. Imposter syndrome is flashing bright neon for her, except instead of Barb's and my fear of a socially embarrassing frog marched by security personnel to the exit, Esther is facing the destruction of her people who are in exile in Babylon. Esther is certainly feeling like an imposter. She's just a Jewish peasant girl who won a beauty contest and now is queen, the favored wife among many political wives. She's been accidentally thrust into close proximity to the seat of power of the greatest empire the world had ever known up to that time. And she is terrified for her life and for her people's lives. She has been silent about her Jewish faith, about her Jewish culture. She's been in the closet this entire time, because she knows of the anti-Jewish hatred of Babylon, and especially of Haman, one of the king's trusted advisors who is devising plans of genocide for the Jewish people. Her position is fragile, terrifyingly vulnerable. She is tenuously connected to the power of Babylon, but if the truth were known about her, she could be killed. If she spoke at the wrong time to the king, she could be killed. Is Esther, in her fear and silence, suffering from imposter syndrome? Yes, and for entirely realistic reasons. She really did not belong where she was. And then she gets the pleading yet stern words from her uncle Mordecai, who is praying and fasting and mourning in sackcloth and ashes. And the message is this: do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Who knows, he finishes. Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. For just such a time as this. Last week, I shared with you all an old Hasidic Jewish story that Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen learned from her grandfather, a rabbi. And I'm going to share it this morning again with you, because I think it's going to be a theme for us for a while. This is the story of the birthday of the world. In the beginning, there was only the holy darkness, the Ein Sof, the source of life. And then in the course of history, at a moment in time, this world, the world of 1,000,000 things, emerged from the heart of the holy darkness as a great ray of light. And the vessels containing the light of the world, the wholeness of the world, broke. And the wholeness of the world, the light of the world, was scattered into 1,000 fragments of light. 1,000,000 fragments of light. And they fell into all events and all people, where they remain deeply hidden until this very day. Now, according to Dr. Remen's grandfather, the rabbi, the whole human race is a response to this accident. We are here because we are born with the capacity to find the hidden light in all events and all people, to lift it up and make it visible once again, and thereby to restore the innate wholeness of the world. This is a very important story for our time, she said, that we heal the world one heart at a time. This task is called Tikkun Olam, repairing, restoring, renewing the world. Not necessarily by making a huge difference. Not everybody is called to make a huge difference. Dr. Remen says it's about healing the world that touches you. Healing the world that's around you. That's where your power is. That's the imposter syndrome for all of us. Thinking we are not enough. That we are not enough to make a difference. That we are not smart enough, or famous enough, or rich enough, or powerful enough, or talented enough, or just someone else enough to change the world. But Dr. Remen says that according to this ancient rabbinic story, we, each of us, are exactly what is needed for just such a time as this. And to just wonder about that a little bit. What if I am exactly what's needed for just such a time as this? How would I live if I were exactly what's needed for just such a time as this? To work with God and to work with others of goodwill, others with a divine spark of light, a fragment of divine light to heal the world, tikkun olam. Christian, Jewish, atheist, Muslim, agnostic, Buddhist, Hindu, anyone, all of us have a spark of light, and each of us is called for just such a time as this. Whether there's a D after your name, or an R, or a P, you have a spark of light, and you are called for just such a time as this. Flatlander, woodchuck, gay, straight, black, white, trans, immigrant, refugee, indigenous, you have a spark of light and you are called for just such a time as this. It's Advent, the new liturgical year. And every day we are called to just such a time as this. Bella, in baptism, has said yes to God's grace, to God's call on her, to a life of more and more clearly recognizing that spark of light in herself and in those around her. Thank you, Bella, for saying yes to God's love and God's calling for you. Dorothy, Sarah, Tracy, Donna, Krista, and Liz, you have said yes to recognizing that tikkun olam is not a solo effort, that we do it in community. And you have said yes to the people of this wonderful little community of faith, yes to recognizing that we have been called to ministry for just such a time as this. If you know the story of Esther, you know that she does risk talking to the king, and she does indeed save her people from genocide. She rose to the occasion. She recognized the spark of light in herself, and even if she felt like an imposter, she knew as a child of God that she had a real calling, and that she was real herself. A real calling for just such a time as this. Oh, and Barb and me, Thursday night at the Echo Center. Jane Sanders was absolutely sweet. We told her who we were. Nobody. We told her our names, and she said they'd seen our names on the list and wondered how we got there. But then she said, well, we asked around and heard, and I quote, we heard warm things about you. What? Now, I suspect she was just making it up and being nice. Or maybe someone on staff mistakenly thought they'd heard our names somewhere. In any case, she invited us to stay for the rest of the conference. And Barb and I think, recognized that even if we were imposters that night, we knew there was the spark of light in us and all the intimidating people we saw around us. And maybe we had been called, however awkwardly, to just such a time as this. And the next day, as Barb and I nervously attended some programs, and folk asked, so what do you do? I could say, I am privileged to serve a faith community in Essex, Vermont, where we are all learning how to heal the world one heart at a time, doing justice, loving kindness, and walking humbly with God for, and you can say it with me, just such a time as this. Amen.